Welcome back, everyone. I am Cass Piancy. I'm joined, as usual, by my partner in crime, Mr. Bennett Tomlin. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you, Cass?
I'm doing good. We're joined by a very special guest, Mr. Danny Nelson, reporter for CoinDesk. First-time guest. It's a pleasure to have you on today, man. How are you?
I'm doing well. Great to be here.
Danny has been at the courtroom for the SBF trial, along with his compatriots, Nick Day, who we had on last week, and Sam Kessler, who we're hoping to have on at some point as well. But yeah, Danny, I would love to hear some of your insights. I know you weren't there for the first day with Nishad, but we can still go over it. We all read the summaries, and You have other friends in the courtroom. So yeah, what was the takeaway from Nishad Singh?
For Nishad, I mean, he was, of course, one of the three insiders one of four insiders along with Sam who really knew what was going on inside FTX, which is to say, knew that everything wasn't what it seemed to be. He was on the FTX side of things. And the testimony that he brought to the courtroom really had this, from what I heard from my colleagues, this cinematic flair. He was really talented in coloring the scene, like talking about the discussion when everything went to shit. It wasn't just a discussion. It was at night on a balcony. People were talking it through. And that kind of stuff makes for really compelling testimony. All those elements started to fall away on day two of his testimony during cross-examination when the defense attorneys, they didn't really discredit him, but they started to poke holes in this picture that he was painting of a guy who maybe sort of knew what was going on, but really felt morally torn by it. I mean, on one hand, he's saying, well, I learned in, let's say, early fall, late summer 2022, that there was this hole and that we were using customer funds. But oh, by the way, in October 2022, I used a loan that I took from Alameda FTX to buy a house in Washington State. It was $3.7 million. So it's like, well, which is it, buddy? Do you feel bad that you're stealing customer money? Or are you looking forward to your house, which, by the way, we looked into it, has a hot tub? Not that hot tub is any more or less nefarious, but it is actually, I looked at it as, it is more nefarious, usually.
So your point here is that they were discrediting him by him pretending he has empathy and sympathy and cares while his actions were perceived differently?
It's little pieces, right? And I have to say, I'm starting to really think Sam did it. I'm just kidding there. Of course he did it, allegedly. But I'm there for the entertainment and for the information. And I find myself rooting for the defense. Like, the case is pretty cut and dry. I think he's going to get convicted. I still want the defense to put up a good fight. I want them to throw some good punches because it's much more interesting that way. And otherwise, you're just sitting in a courtroom all day. And you don't want just the prosecution to be doing well because they are doing well. So the defense, the strategy that they're taking during their cross-examinations is just, how do we chip away at people's credibility, which is a cornerstone of being a good defense lawyer. And for Nishad, one of the ways they were doing that, and something they've tried with all of the witnesses, is taking statements that the witnesses made to prosecutors in their extensive interviews pre-trial and bringing them up and seeing if their memories match. And for most of the witnesses, the major ones anyway, their memories match up pretty good. For Nishad, there were a whole bunch of moments where he wasn't quite remembering the very specific jarring things he had been telling prosecutors months before. Now, that doesn't mean that everything he says is bull. It does, I think, serve the purpose of making the jury think, well, maybe this guy who really had a wonderful, very clear of mind story to tell about how everything went down. Well, he remembers it was night on the balcony and, like, I don't know, there was a Big Dipper up or something. He didn't say that part, but would have been a nice little flair. He remembers all those things really well, but he can't remember this other thing he told prosecutors. So little bits like that made me think, and I think made other people in the courtroom too also think, this guy might be a little too polished in some areas.
I have open on my computer right now an article that you co-wrote with Nick and Sam about this period of the trial where we see kind of the cross-examination. And I thought some of the things you highlighted that came up in that cross were particularly funny. Like, at one point, they're discussing the penthouse apartment at the Orchid that they were living in. And apparently, what the defense attorney tried to ask was this penthouse really that extraordinary for you all? I mean, you were all rich, right? Mm-hmm. So shouldn't live in a penthouse? Which I thought was an interesting little detail when you consider the nature and source of their wealth. Did you have thoughts on that particular moment?
Before I get to Nishad's response, I will go back to Yedidia, Adam Yedidia. He worked at FTX. I don't think he knew of things going the way they went until they went to shit, which is today. I don't think he knowingly committed crimes, unlike some of the people that are appearing in the courtroom. Yedidia was asked to compare the co-living $30 million apartment to a dorm room. He was like, it was just like a dorm room, but more luxurious, which was quite a telling line. For Nishad, I mean, I think it's kind of a fair point. Like we actually used our customer funds to buy this thing, notwithstanding. If you think you have $1 billion, you probably shouldn't be living in like a ranch home. Now, Warren Buffett still lives in a ranch home, so maybe that's not true, but most of the billionaires don't. They live in big, big, big places. His response, which was basically, I don't know billionaires. I don't really know what's right and what's wrong. I don't know. I don't know about that. Because he also lived in, by his words, the nicest room in the house. So he just got a lot of mixed messaging from that guy.
Well, and at a fundamental level, in a very real sense, none of them were billionaires.
Oh, no.
I mean, they were in a certain sense in paper.
But oh, yes.
Like, that all depended on a certain fiction being maintained.
Exactly. That they, even if the money wasn't stolen, they were at best paper billionaires. They did not have the liquid capital. And of course, they weren't even actual billionaires in that respect because it wasn't their money.
I guess this was the first time anyone has seen the defense kind of wake up. I've been mentioning Liz a lot. She wrote an article entitled Sam Bankman-Fried's Defense Finally Woke Up in The Verge. And it seemed like even Joe Bankman and Barbara Fried seemed to kind of agree, or like at least their outward emotions were that they were pleased with this cross-examination. But the week didn't end with Nishad Singh, right? I mean, we had more witnesses after this. Can you clue me into some of the other witnesses?
Probably the best witness of the week was the expert witness, Peter Easton. Now, he is an accounting professor at Notre Dame. He's served as an editor of many of the top accounting journals. I'm going to have to take his word for it because I don't read the accounting journals. And he came out guns blazing with really, really telling charts that illustrated where the money was coming from. Let's say we have the customer funds, and the way that we now understand FTX to have been set up was, if you wanted to get your money into FTX, your cash, like your dollars, you wired those dollars to a bank account called North Dimension or some smaller accounts, but mostly North Dimension, and they were controlled, the beneficiary of Alameda. And then once your money's in there, you have access on the FTX side to use that money, but the money never actually always completed the transfer from North Dimension to FTX. Instead, they just did some really bad bookkeeping. And the result of this setup was they could then take the money out of those bank accounts and move that money into all the other different things that they were really spending the money on, like real estate, political donations, the charities, like
venture capital, specifically half a billion dollars to Anthropic.
I don't even remember what point of the trial this was, but there was this whole argument in court about, well, look, they made this bet on Anthropic and it did well. And so he was using the money responsibly. But then Judge Kaplan said, look, you can't, if I rob the Federal Reserve and I take $1 million and I buy a lot of Powerball tickets and one of them hits, well, I still robbed the Federal Reserve. So it doesn't mean that I shouldn't, that I was okay to have robbed the bank. I still robbed the bank. You can't say, well, everyone got their money back because the stolen money was used in a way that made more money. No, that's not valid. So yes, they got lucky with their ill-gotten gains on Anthropic. all that notwithstanding, Peter Easton, the accounting professor, used these charts to show there's not enough other money to possibly in any way pay for many of the things that they paid for, whether it was paying back lenders. I don't think they spoke specifically about Anthropic in the charts, but buying the Genesis Digital Assets, the Bitcoin mining company in Kazakhstan, that was, I think, $1 billion investment.
1.1.
Yeah, 1.1 billion, thanks. I don't remember the exact breakdown, but hundreds of millions of those dollars could have only come from customer deposits. There was just no other money. And so that was really compelling testimony, because we've heard people say, we used the money in ways that weren't for the customers. We've heard them say that, but we haven't seen how it actually happened until then. And so for me, that was a very powerful moment where I actually got to piece together these statement allegations over here with the outcome. Well, now I see how the money flowed. And that's a really important part, right? Because otherwise it's just he said, she said to an extent.
This is exhibit, I'm looking at it right now in front of me, exhibit 1041. And this exhibit shows customer funds from customer bank accounts and other inflows amounting to a little over $500 million. And they go to Alameda Research, like you just described. And then that those deposits are sent to Silvergate. And then those deposits then get meased out to Silvergate and Signature and Signet, which is Signet, for anyone who's unaware, was like the internal distribution ledger for cryptocurrency companies within Signature Bank. And then it goes to Signet, and then it goes to Prime Trust, and then it goes to Prime Trust, and then it goes to Anthropic. And yeah, that's just bank fraud, right? What they're showing is bank fraud. And there's really, I don't know what else you could possibly call this. I don't know how the defense can in any way suggest this isn't bank fraud. I guess the suggestion is that it's bad bookkeeping and Sam wasn't necessarily the one doing it. Am I getting that right? I don't know what they're, I have no idea what the argument is against
well,
this.
Well, you know, I'll give it to them there. It was definitely bad bookkeeping. But bad bookkeeping is an essential element of bank fraud, at least in this case. So no, Sam may not have been the one always like pushing the button to execute the bank transaction, but he doesn't need to have been. This is a conspiracy case as well. It's not just a bank, it's just a wire fraud case. It's a conspiracy to commit wire fraud. So sometimes that would have been Nishad. Maybe that was Ryan Salem. The point is, well, the CEO of these companies, according to the witnesses, knew about this all happened. It was just a fraud all the way down. I think on cross-examination, the defense tried to discredit Peter Easton. I mean, I don't quite remember how they went about it, because they didn't really do a successful job. And it's interesting, because the defense did score some points on other witnesses brought by the prosecutors that were trying to illustrate how the bank fraud aspect of this went down. Like the one of the last witnesses of the day on Wednesday or Thursday was a forensic accountant from the FBI. She was talking about the different methods that accountants use to track money, because if a bank account has more than one inflow, then it's hard to say with certainty that the outflow came from more than one inflow, because money is fungible, right? If I have a painting and I send you the painting and you send the painting to someone else, well, there's only one painting. We don't need to talk about JPEGs. There's only one painting. If I have $2 and I send Cass those $2, but Barrett, you send him $3, and then Cass sends Burrito $1, well, who's to say which pot of money it came from? So the accountant was saying, well, I used LIFO, last in, first out, that method. But there's another method called FIFO. First in, first out. I'll just summarize this by saying the defense actually caught her, it seemed like, saying that she used this one method, but she seemed to have screwed up. And that wasn't actually the right conclusion to have been made from whatever method she used. I'm sorry I got a little boring on this tangent, but I just want to say the defense hasn't been feckless on these points, and they have been able to score some hits. But on Peter Easton, I described him as Australian Santa Claus, and then I used the very illustrative image of Santa Claus beating Sam Bankman-Fried with a sock full of coal in my newsletters, which was a little much, but I stand by it. They did not succeed in discrediting him.
I thought some of the most interesting testimony of this past week came from one of FTX's former lawyers, Kan Sun. Can you speak to some of the things that they were testifying about, and what that reveals about Sam Bankman-Fried and the alleged crimes he committed?
Kan Sun was the general counsel of FTX. He had worked with FTX prior to joining it when he was at Fenwick & West, which is a law firm that works with crypto companies. I guess that's the description that I'll use. He was their in-house counsel, and he came in to finish up the terms of service in, I think, late 2021 or early 2022. He did that. By his telling, he was not aware of any of this. And ultimately when he found out, or when he said he found out about it all, which was, I think, November 9th or whenever the big reveal was, he quit the next day. But the most compelling part of his testimony was that day when he found out from Nishad and from Sam what had happened, because there were all these calls with, I think it was Apollo. Sam was trying to raise money because the customers were having trouble getting money out of FTX. He was going to the venture investors trying to plug the hole. Now, the hole, how big is the hole? No one was really, no one outside of the inner circle at FTX at that point knew really how big the hole was. And Ken Sun says he didn't either. He knew bits before, like that Alameda had special access. And he had said, this is terrible. Well, he said to Sam at the time, this is terrible. We need to get rid of this weird allow negative feature. And he, on his side, he said he wrote up all the legal stuff to take care of it. On the business side, he later learned they never actually took care of it, even though they told him they had. On the day it all went down, he found out that there was this hole. He found out how big the hole was. And then Sam went to him saying, Apollo has come to me. They want a justification for why we've used like billions of dollars of customer deposits. Can you make me a justification? And first, Ken Sun said, like, this is not, no. And then he like looked, I guess he's the lawyer, right? So he looked into it and he came up with some theoretical explanations, but he said he told Sam, like, none of these actually hold any water, right? We can't say that the money came from the spot margin account, which customers of FTX could put their money in to loan it out, because there just wasn't enough money in that account. Hundreds of millions of dollars for a $1 billion hole. So that doesn't work. And then he told Sam a couple of different theoretical explanations, none of which would actually work. And then Sam sort of said, yep. That's actually the quote from Ken Sun. Sam's response to the time was, yep, got it. It's really compelling stuff. And then Ken Sun quit the very next day. He resigned because he was like, this is illegal and we're all going to jail. He didn't say we're all going to jail in the courtroom, but I bet he was thinking it.
It's subtext. It's subtext. Yes, that was definitely the subtext of all of his testimony. I thought this testimony was so interesting because it was this lawyer for FTX who apparently was not aware of these things, which kind of explains why Sam Bankman-Fried's defense have not gone for like a formal advice of counsel defense, which is when you're charged with criminal defenses, one of your defenses you have could be to say that you talked with a lawyer, you asked them, is this illegal? The lawyer said, no, this is not illegal, and you believe that in good faith. And that is an actual defense for crimes, and it involves a certain set of requirements. And at times, SBF's defense lawyers have been asked if that's what they intend to do, because they keep mentioning FTX's lawyers and who saw certain loans and things like that. So I think Ken Sun's testimony is really important because it shows that Sam Bankman-Fried was not asking his lawyers, can we take these customer funds to do this? It was much more of after the fact, hey, we took customer funds. Do you have any lawyer tricks that can get me out of this? Mm-hmm. I've got some interviews I need to do and some tweets to make. What's the best combination of words I can say that'll, make it all go away? And so I thought that was the really powerful thing about Ken Sun's testimony, is it kind of stripped away the vestiges of that kind of defense that his lawyers have been hinting at this whole time.
And they have been hinting at it a little bit in the crosses, I guess. But in the opening statements, they were actually barred from referencing the advice of counsel defense by Judge Kaplan. She said, like, in pretrial, he said, you just can't do this. In a way, Sam actually did take the advice of counsel ultimately, because Ken Sun told him, look, there's this theoretical explanation, this borrow-lend program we have that could explain the whole. And then Ken Sun said, but it doesn't actually work because it was hundreds of millions of dollars versus billions of dollars. Well, after it all went down, and in that month before Sam was arrested in the Bahamas, he went on his media tour and he went on Good Morning America with George Stephanopoulos. They played this in the courtroom, this clip, where George asks Sam, like, what happened to the money? And Sam is very halting, doesn't sound very convincing, searching for words. And ultimately, one of the things he says is, well, we have this borrow-lend program, and people were consenting to their money being loaned out, and that's how the whole happened.
But as you know, the FTX Terms of Service tell the people who signed up, none of the digital assets in your account are the property of, or shall be, or may be loaned to FTX Trading. But you're saying that happened.
My understanding is a few things happened. The first is there is a margin trading facility on FTX by which users can lend out funds, by which other users borrow funds. And so there are explicit cases where there is, you know, margin extended, where there is borrow lending.
If yep. Alameda is borrowing the money that belongs yep. to FTX depositors, that's a bright red line, isn't it?
There are a lot of cases where that's actually explicitly part of the programs and that are
but
happening.
Not here. Here it says that the digital assets may not be loaned to FTX trading.
Well, that's true to a very limited respect. And it's also just not at all the reality of the situation. But his lawyer did say it. So maybe that was advice of counsel.
Anything you hear any lawyer say in any context is advice, right?
Like I guess
when I talk to a friend of mine who's a lawyer and he says, do you want a beer? That's advice to have another beer, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that's the way it works. I want to give a little bit of extra context on Can Sun because we've actually talked about him on this show before. He's not a super important character in cryptocurrency, but he does show up in episode 122. Can Sun previously worked at Fenwick & West with Daniel Friedberg, as Danny mentioned, before eventually coming over to FTX. What's interesting is the former CEO of Trust Labs, which used to be behind some of the Trustcoin tokens, Daniel Zhayung An, in his pro se lawsuit against Archblock, the company that is now what was once Trust Token, alleged that Can Sun was representing Justin Sun and Tron in their attempted acquisition of TrueUSD. And so I just wanted to make sure everyone was aware that Can Sun's connections apparently bridge from Sam Bankman-Fried, FTX, Alameda Research, Justin Sun, Tron, TrueUSD, Daniel Friedberg, Fenwick & West, just that cluster. I want to make sure everyone sees that cluster before we move on.
The exhibit has been entered into the record.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm going to have some witnesses on the stand just to read some blog posts and piss off the judge.
Oh, that was so painful. Actually, it was great because I love when the judge gets fiery.
But he's been amazing.
Those witnesses.
And hey, listen, this was him getting angry at the prosecution for once, Danny. It was giving the defense a fighting chance, keeping your underdog story alive.
Oh, absolutely. Gotta love a good underdog story.
Bad underdog story. I mean, it doesn't have to be a good underdog.
I want the story to be good, even if it's about bad people.
If this court case doesn't get any more exciting, all the many movies they're going to make about Sam Bankman-Fried are all going to end in November 2022.
No. So we know it's going to get more exciting in some sense, right? Because we're going to be taking a break in terms of the trial next week for most of the week. Does trial start again on Friday? Thursday?
Trial starts on Thursday. The judge is going to a conference, so he has given us, in his words, an intermission.
So most of the week is going to be off, but what we're being told, and there's been some craziness around this, but what we're being told is that Sam Bankman-Fried has been given his extended release Adderall, so they believe he's good to go when it comes to taking the stand, which I'm not sure his lawyers actually want him to do, but it sounds like he wants to do that, and so it's gonna happen. Is that supposed to happen next week or the week after that?
The defense has been coy about whether they're even going to bring a case at all, because they don't need to bring a case. The way that I'm thinking about this, though, is, well, first off, if you're a criminal defendant, the starting point in your mental model is, it should be, I should not take the stand, because one, you get to tell your side of the story, which is great for you. But then prosecutors get to cross-examine you and ask you, like, Sam, so in this testimony that you wrote for Congress that you never got to give, you start out with, I fucked up. What did you mean by I fucked up, right? So that's what they get to do. And that's not very good, because you did fuck up. In your words, you fucked up. And they get to figure out why you did, and that will make you look not good. But the trial has been going so poorly for him. In my opinion, it's not like he's going to nuke the whole thing by testifying. He can only go up from here. So he may as well do it.
I don't know about that. I think it is absolutely
right, it's a binary, right? It's not a binary, because there could be a hung jury, but maybe on the sentencing side of things, it can get worse. But
yeah, he can definitely make himself look worse here, is what I'm saying. Like, everyone keeps saying, might as well Hail Mary it, and I'm like, I don't know about that as a like a legal methodology. Maybe don't just, you know, Hail Mary it. I don't know.
Well, I hope he does. And I think he will. And if he does, the scheduling side of things, the defense is going to have its opportunity to bring a case starting on Thursday after lunch. If they do bring a case, which I believe they will, they'll probably have a couple of witnesses. And then it would be Sam. I don't know why they would have Sam as anyone but the last person. It doesn't make any sense to have him as anyone but the last person. In fact, the way that this trial is working, Judge Goppin said to Sam at the very beginning, look, it is ultimately your decision to testify or not. You can take the advice of your counsel on this matter, at least. But if, let's say, they don't let you testify and you want to anyway, you could just stand up. That's what he said. He said, stand up and I'll send the jury out of the room and I'll ask you why you're standing up. And then you'll say, if this is why, I want to testify. And then even if it's after the defense has rested its case, Judge Kaplan will let him take the stand. Sam is the kind of guy who wants to say his piece. I think that his lawyers are smart enough to manage the situation well enough that if he's going to just do it anyway, they're going to bring it about themselves instead of letting him just stand up after they rested their case. So he could testify as early, if he is to testify, as early as Thursday, maybe Friday, or the week following that, which is a Monday through Thursday week, which should be the last week of the trial.
The best scenario for those of us with newsletters to write, though, is that he does the choice where the defense rests and then he stays standing. That's the best case scenario for those of us with newsletters to write.
Yes, that would be very juicy.
I think you're right, though, that they are trying to manage it to the best case scenario. Mm. That's why they're spending the time writing letters about the specific formulation of Adderall they hope to make available to him for his testimony, because they want to make this as least damaging as possible.
That also gave them a nice, cute way to at least appeal the sentencing and stuff, is to be like, well, he was medicated incorrectly. They even said in the whatever the memo, the writ for medication, they said specifically, like, we want him to have extended release so that it covers the whole trial. Oh, but we're not sure if it's going to work, which I'm just like, oh, OK. I mean, I see what you're doing here. All of that being said, it sure sounds like he's going to take the stand, and it sounds like the defense is going to have a relatively short case if they have one at all. Is sentencing directly after that? Is that how this is going to work?
That's a good question. I don't think so. I've covered a lot of criminal cases at CoinDesk. Doesn't usually go to a jury trial. And so often when it doesn't and there's a plea or something else, I don't know, there's a sentencing hearing that's scheduled months later. So I don't know what happens when you get a conviction. I believe that it doesn't happen right away, though. We'll have to see about that. I think it probably wouldn't be right away, because I think that when there's a sentencing hearing, you actually get to hear from a lot of victims who say what happened to them. That might just be in the movies. But this is very cinematic, so it might apply here too.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, awesome. Thank you for joining us, Danny. For anyone who's interested, we're going to be having Katie Baker on from The Ringer next week, and then we're going to be having some more guests after that. So continue to check us out, because we're getting to have all the cool journalists who are sitting in the courtroom on with us.
Are you guys going to come in for any of it? It's a lot of fun.
I'm in Cali, so there's just no way it's going to happen.
It's a whole experience. In fact, everyone should sign up for my newsletter. Please do. It's a great newsletter. I get to be very spicy in it, not like in our normal, more straightforward press coverage. I get to write things like, counting Santa Claus beat Sam Bankman-Fried's lawyers with a sock full of coal.
I want to add, yes, there's a bunch. What I've been really enjoying is I've actually been taking in different perspectives from as many different media outlets as I can. And each one is a little bit different. And I get a really great feeling for what it's like, even being in line to go into the courtroom.
But
like,
only
I feel
one of them has a counting Santa Claus beating Sam Bankman-Fried with a sack full of coal.
Well, actually, a few of them have a counting Santa Claus, but only one of them is he violent with a sock full of coal.